Welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So get yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. If you or I were dealing with a mind that was growing morbid, we should be chiefly concerned not so much to give it arguments as to give it air, to convince it that there was something cleaner and cooler outside the suffocation of a single argument. G.K. Chesterton, Orthodoxy. In a world grown sick with cynicism, perhaps fairy tales provide just such a breath of fresh air. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. I am talking to you from a very misty Scotland. It is a Saturday morning, and I have lazily drunk several cups of tea and am now sitting down to have a new podcast, and I have with me a very special guest. This is my friend, Bose Harrington. Say hello, Bose.
Hello.
Bose and I met on the internet in a very typically millennial fashion. I was thinking back on how I first came to know Bose, and I think it was through his Twitter account. What's your handle on Twitter, Bose?
At Sketches by Bose.
I discovered Bose's account years ago, I think probably in 2015. And it is, or 2016, it is a, it's this mixture of whimsical and literary jokes and flashes of hope in the world. And so I just bumped across it one day and I followed it. And I don't follow many accounts on Twitter because the world is full of information and I didn't need one more thing to make me overwhelmed or sad. So I discovered Bose's account and it was full of literary delight and hope, and all the things that I enjoy. And so then Bose eventually, somehow we connected and have kind of gone back and forth many times over books, favorite books that we share, and kind of a similar way of seeing the world. So I'm very happy to have him on my podcast today, and I will preface this with my computer's audio may not be perfect for this, so turn it up and enjoy what you can hear. So, Bose, give us a little introduction to you. What do you do with your days? What's your official profession? Are you a writer? Are you a tweeter? What do you busy yourself with?
Well, currently I'm a freelance writer who writes historical romances and cozy mysteries. And I am working on, I think, 3 novels of my own for submission to publication. So I'm hoping to have a book published within the next year or two.
That is very exciting. So we have a proper writer with us. So you said you write historical fiction and cozy mysteries. What era are those taking place in?
I go back and forth between contemporary and the 1810s and 20s. I'm really at home in the era of Jane Austen right now. Like, I have been reading a lot of her and Georgette Heyer and other people who write like her.
Oh, that's delightful. How fun. So let's see. Okay, so I thought I would ask you, what are some of your favorite books and stories? And I'm going to ask this in 2 categories. First, what are your favorite, like, old classics dear to your heart forever? And then second, what are your favorite new discoveries?
Growing up, I was really fascinated by, I think, really whimsical stories, like Alice in Wonderland, The Phantom Tollbooth, Phoenix and the Carpet was a favorite. And I discovered Dickens early on, and he sort of combines gothic and whimsical in a delightful way. And then that eventually led me to Chesterton, who we'll be talking about.
That's interesting that Dickens kind of led you to Chesterton. I, as a kid, loved Dickens, which is sort of odd. I think Dickens, I've discovered that many people either kind of have a taste for Dickens or they don't. But I'm personally of the opinion that everyone should have a taste for Dickens.
Agreed.
Yes. And I've made a habit of every year I always read Christmas Carol in December. And my sister used to tell me, she would like pick me up from class, because my sister is 11 years older than me. And so she would, you know, being the good older sibling, she would drive me to classes. And whenever she would pick me up, she would always say that I would give her these descriptions of people, and she'd always describe them as Dickensian, because I would try to kind of, you know, capture my classmates and their various foibles and giftings. And I'm sure that I was trying to be Dickens, because I just enjoyed reading Dickens so much. But he does really kind of capture the darkness and the whimsy of life, and kind of helps you see the gravity of people, but also, like, the silliness. What are some of your favorite Dickens books?
I really love David Copperfield, mm-hmm. the book that got me started on Dickens.
So I hope that that has given you a quick peek into who Bowes is, and I'm happy to have him on today. And we are going to talk about something which we have been chatting back and forth about doing for quite a while now, and that is on fairy stories in a secular age. Now, to get this started off, I'm going to do my kind of a bit of academic culture, putting our finger on the pulse of the world we live in, and then we're going to discuss our three pieces of art today. And basically, the question that we're looking at is, why are fairy stories, or stretching our imagination beyond the realm of just what you might call realism, why are they important in our world, in our world of facts and fact-checking and you know, and quick and rushing life? What is it about fairy stories? Are they important? And if so, why? And as you might be able to guess, Bowes and I are both of the opinion that we think they are very important. And so we're going to look at that today. But I wanted to start off with kind of giving you a background. This is also what we'll be talking about today. I worked on a lot for a paper last year, and it really helped me. I was already of the conviction that fairy stories and imagination was important, but it even more fully developed my view of that. And so I wanted to begin with kind of, as Charles Taylor would call it, a sketch of the modern consciousness. So, The Secular Age is a book that no one has actually read all of. I'm of the firm opinion. It is a tome. It's absolutely huge. But it is also very, very brilliant. The bits that I have read have been really incisive to me. It's rare that I discover a book where I go, ah, yes, that really describes something in our world succinctly and truly, where you just go, yes, that's right. But basically what he tries to discover is, how did we go from a world in which people found it difficult not to believe in God, in an enchantment, in a world that was charged with meaning and beauty, into a world where even the most sincere believers found it difficult to believe, and where everything was marked, rather than marked with a sense of meaning and enchantment and beauty, it was marked with a sense of secularity, of there not being any meaning inherent in anything. And how did that kind of shift take place? And Taylor, rather than talking about this like in a series of beliefs that we have changed, or in a series of, you know, political movements, he talks about this kind of as a shift of experience of the world, as a shift of consciousness. And the way he describes it, he says that we've all been kind of caught in what he calls the imminent frame. So the imminent frame is kind of this way of feeling through and experiencing the world. And there's kind of a good way to think of it is, it's how we experience the natural world, how we experience ourselves, and how we experience time. So he says that we shifted in the natural world. We experience it now, or we are meant to in the secular age, in the imminent frame, as kind of this feeling of, it's a machine. So we've gone from seeing, he talks about, we've gone from seeing the world as a place, to we see the natural world now as a space, as an empty space that doesn't have a sense of order and meaning. And that's not to say that we don't see it as, you know, having order and precision and all those things, but that there was kind of the shift in the modern movement into science and all that, that kind of the way we talked about and described the natural world and science was that it was just a great big machine. And that didn't mean that God didn't exist, but that he was probably outside of the machine. The machine didn't need him to go on making it tick. And so that was how we experienced the natural world. It was very disenchanted. It was a great big ticking clock. Then the second thing was ourself. We went from, you know, a world in the Middle Ages where everyone was connected and community had this sense of kind of overlapping patterns, and that you were connected to your neighbor and to your family and to your church, and that yourself was defined by those relationships, And where your choices were defined by a sense of narrative and your connections and the way it would impact the world around you, to this kind of sense that we have now where it's more focused on autonomy and individualism. And this is not to criticize necessarily those things, but it's to say that is the shift to how we have begun to experience the world. And then finally, that we've shifted in experience of time. And I talked about this a lot with Joel in the episode a few weeks ago, that we've gone from this sense of time as circular and as being planted in the church year, and being a sense of narrative and a sense of kind of recurrence, to this kind of time as linear, having no arc or sense of recapitulation. So that's kind of a sketch of how it feels to be in the secular age, according to Taylor. What he also notes is that all of us feel, and I think I can truly say that all of us feel, that this doesn't quite describe life. As Chesterton says in Orthodoxy, which we'll be talking about, they've explained the whole world, and the whole world does not seem worth explaining. And Taylor calls this the hauntedness, the feeling that there's much, much more in the world, that there's much more beauty and meaning and something beyond. So that's kind of where we begin today, is saying, if we believe that, how do we kind of try on new ways of seeing, new ways of experiencing the world? How do we tap into what we feel instinctively must be true about the world, that there's much more than this kind of box of the mechanistic natural world. There's much more than what the world might lead us to believe. So today we're going to, my kind of thesis is that I think that fairy stories, that imagination, that all these things kind of bring us out. They kind of help us. It's like the immanent frame is like a glass above us, and they help us not only see through, but kind of break out of this experience of the world and help us imagine a new way of seeing and a new way of experiencing the world that actually leads us deeper into reality. So I've been talking a lot. Bose, is there anything that strikes you as I'm talking about that, like about either the experience of the immanent frame or that feeling of hauntedness that we all kind of go, no, this isn't enough. Like, this is not all there is.
It's very eloquent what you said, but as religious believers, it can be hard to break out of this sense that we're just monkeys living on a ball floating through space, because that's the noise that we hear around us all the time. And that's sort of the story that Western civilization has been telling itself for the last 200 years. And I think what we sometimes forget is that while it's one story about the world, it's just a story. And whatever the facts of the natural world might be, there have been other stories that we've told ourselves in history. And those stories are getting drowned out by there's this conglomeration of consumerism, capitalism, technology, I would say the liberal order, if you want to put it all in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And these things work together to sort of keep us blind to the spiritual realities underpinning the world. And so one way of resisting this, I think of it like A Wrinkle in Time. I've been revisiting that book recently in anticipation of the movie. It's a great book, and I never understood what was going on in the last half of that book when I was a kid, because there were these people living under a dark spiritual force, and they were all acting the same way. And I thought it was an analogy for communism, but it turns out she was also attacking American conformity and capitalism in the 1950s, which fascinates me. And, so Madeleine Lingle, if you've read any of her theology essays or essays on art and writing, she was a strong believer that we are under attack from forces that are trying to disenchant the world, to destroy nature and destroy imagination. As she felt, and C.S. Lewis felt, and Tolkien felt, that the way to resist this was through not just religious belief and practice, although that's important, but through community,
mm-hmm.
and through imagination and through writing and through fairy stories, actually. A lot of people scoff at that, and they say, how can fairy stories be of any relevance to us? They're just stories about things that couldn't possibly happen. But when you're fighting a world system and a world order that tells us that only what we can see with our eyes is important, then you need stories where strange and surprising and wonderful things happen to kind of jolt you out of the reality of that you see around you into a different reality.
I absolutely love that, and I think you're so right. And I think that's what I liked about Taylor is when he has this quote where he says that in our secular age, in this kind of in the matrix of what you described of the different things that kind of conspire to make us think that there is nothing beyond what we can see and touch, even the people who are most faithful kind of have to fight to both believe but also to experience that there is something beyond this imminent frame, and that it's not a passive thing. We must fight to preserve that sense of meaning and that sense of there being more than just the conformity and the not meaning of the natural world. And I think part of our battle plan should be on fairy stories. So with that, we're going to move a little bit into discussing three kind of examples of how fairy stories can kind of break that imminent frame, that can kind of help, that can help be hammers that get us out of the sense of conformity, of locking us into that experience of the, you know, the mechanistic natural world, the isolated self, and the meaningless time. And so just as a little preface, we'll be looking at G.K. Chesterton, The Man Who Was Thursday,
Yes.
and yay! And that is a favorite of mine, and Chesterton is just generally a favorite of both of ours. We'll be looking at Dear Wormwood, and then we'll be talking about The Lord of the Rings. Now, I kind of cheated because I just wanted to talk about Lord of the Rings, and I'm using that as my visual example because it's a film, but you should absolutely read the books, and don't take this as an endorsement of only the films, because as great as they are, nothing can match the enchantment of being immersed in Middle-earth. So we're going to begin by diving into G.K. Chesterton and his works, The Man Who Was Thursday, and his book of essays, Orthodoxy. So I'm going to give you a brief biographical sketch of Chesterton, and then Bose is going to fill in the lines, so to speak, with color. So Chesterton was an author who lived from 1874 to 1936. He was a journalist and a prolific essay writer. He carried around a notebook at all times and said that he wrote so often that if he didn't have a notebook with him, he would write on his sleeve, what's cuffs on the as cuffs on his sleeves. He was first a He went to art school where he was trained in sketching and in painting, and he had something of a mental breakdown there that was followed shortly afterwards by his conversion to Christianity and then eventually down the road in his conversion to Catholicism. And he wrote prolifically. There's so much writing by him, from essays to novels to he's very famous for his mystery stories, the Father Brown mysteries, and his apologetic works. It's really interesting because he wrote a work called The Everlasting Man, this was kind of his most famous apologetic work, and Lewis was known to recommend this to people. He said it was the best work of apologetics that you could read. And as far as I know, like Chesterton and Lewis and Tolkien never met, but Tolkien and Lewis both read much of Chesterton. And he's a very influential writer and a very colorful character. So Bose, why don't you fill us in on some of who Chesterton was as a person.
After Dickens, Chesterton's probably my most favorite writer, and a lot of that has to do with his hilarious, bizarre personality. He was one of the, I would say, strangest and most whimsical people who ever lived. He was like a character out of Lord of the Rings. He was like Tom Bombadil, but in real life. You get a sense of him by looking at his essays and things that he would talk about. He wrote one essay he wrote was called On Chasing After One's Hat. Another was called On Lying in Bed. And it begins with one of the best first lines of an essay ever. He says, "Lying in bed would be an altogether perfect and supreme experience if one only had a colored pencil long enough to draw on the ceiling. So there you go. He was even he had many friends in England, and it was said he had no enemies because even his ideological opponents loved him because he was so witty and so effervescent and so hilarious. There's a famous story about him that an angry old woman came up to him during the First World War and said, "Mr. Chesterton, why aren't you out at the front?" And Chesterton said to her, "Madam," he was very fat, and he said, "Madam, if you go around to the side, you will see that I am."
Oh my gosh.
And so there's a movement to make him a saint because he was such a good person and such a happy person, sort of like a modern day Saint Francis. And his whole thing was that he could see the darkness of life, but he could also see kind of the brilliance and beauty of life because he was such a sensitive person that everything was astonishingly strange to him. And he said, "If you want to understand the importance and greatness and meaning of something, try to pretend as if it did not exist." And Franz Kafka, who sort of was the other, like the opposite side of that coin, said something about him that has really profoundly affected me. He read some of Chesterton's stories, and he put down the book after he'd finished reading, and he said, "This man is so happy, I can almost believe that he has found God."
And that's really something coming from Kafka, who was, the famous story from Kafka is the Metamorphosis about a man who becomes a beetle, or a cockroach, and was famously his whole life struggled with depression. And so that is saying something and communicates the contagious, effervescent, and uncontrollable jocularity of Chesterton. Something that I love about Chesterton is he just it's like Bose was talking about earlier with kind of a love of Dickens. He just turns the world on its head. Chesterton has this ability to kind of look at the natural world and just find absolute wonder and absurdism in it. It was funny, we did a section in one of my classes last year on postmodern absurdism. And of course, that could be this very kind of like spiral into this very depressing thing. But there's also this kind of like this attitude that they take with looking at the world of what a bizarre thing it is to be alive or to be a human or to have two legs. And when I read Chesterton, I kind of get some of that absurdism. Like he experiences the world as this strange and absurd thing, so that you can experience wonder once again. To me, that is part of the emotional force of The Man Who Is Thursday, is that it's taking the world and turning everything in its head and disorienting you so that you can re-encounter the world with wonder. And which I think kind of functions to break that sense of the mechanistic of the natural world and the immanent frame. And how does one even begin to describe the plot of The Man Who Is Thursday?
It's probably my favorite novel and one of the, I think, strangest books ever written. People have attempted to put it into a genre, but it's like eight different genres. It's like a spy novel, a poem, a horror story, a theological essay, but it's really, in the end, it's its own thing. It's like Alice in Wonderland plus Dickens plus the Book of Job.
Yes, absolutely. What's kind of funny is it's always been one of my favorite books as well, and I wrote an essay on it when I was at Oxford, and it was by far the worst essay I wrote because I think it was because I loved it so much that I was just so concerned that I wouldn't do it justice, and then I absolutely didn't do it justice because there's so much to get at and to enjoy and to reap from it. But the basic premise is the very beginning is you kind of encounter this character named Gabriel Syme, and he encounters a group of anarchists, an anarchist poetry group, right? Is that how it begins? And he gets kind of drawn. I almost don't want to say too much about it because I want people to discover it on their own.
There are so many surprises.
But yes, it is a book full of surprises. The whole way through, as you read, you just continue to go, what? 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 And And so it's kind of a mixture of a detective novel, and like you said, it has all these different genres. Now, something I wanted to connect to it is I also love a book of Chesterton's essays called Orthodoxy, and they're
Written in the same year, going through this spiritual journey while he was writing The Man Who Was Thursday. And actually, he said later that writing The Man Who Was Thursday helped bring him out of a deep depression and sort of a crisis of faith. It was after he wrote these two books that he was able to come out of sort of this horrifying way he'd seen the world into seeing it as a beautiful place, and a place that was absurd but also beautiful.
It's interesting too, because I think that very much matches up with, like, there's a chapter in Orthodoxy called The Madman, is it, or The Maniac? Yeah. And he talks about madness as being this, like, this of being circular reasoning. It's getting caught into one argument, and that's where that quote where it says, you've explained the whole world and the world doesn't seem worth explaining, comes from. But I think that in a big way, he was describing his own experience of this kind of depression and this, as you said, the horrifying way of seeing the world. And it's interesting too, because Gabriel Syme, has also been said, I don't remember if he ever said this, but I've heard read lots of things on it, that it's his initials, and Syme is meant to be the same. So it's kind of a picture of his own character, him identifying with this character going through this kind of escape from madness into seeing the world as a strange and difficult and good place. So these books kind of go together. One of the quotes that I love from Orthodoxy that I think helps me kind of understand and identify what he was doing in Man Who Is Thursday is this. He's talking about fairy stories. These fairy stories that break beyond reality, and he says this: "These tales say that apples were golden only to refresh the forgotten moment when we found out they were green. They make rivers run with wine only to make us remember for one wild moment that they run with water." So, in saying this, he's kind of helping us go that fairy stories make the world one way so that we can remember our own world and realize how marvelous and strange it is. You know, we just accept it as it is because it's the world in which we live. But his whole point is we've forgotten the wonder of even existing, of the wonder that the world is the way it is, and that why don't we see that as its own sort of magic?
There's a story that he likes to tell where he was walking into a coffee shop, and he looked at the glass in the door frame, and it said Emor Fok, and he was like, "What is Emor Fok? I've never heard of that place." And then he went around the door and he realized it was coffee room. The moment he had forgotten what a coffee room was, and he had the most like this epiphany where I'm actually in a strange place, this incredible coffee shop, but I don't know, I'm familiar with it, so it doesn't seem strange to me. But if I step outside of my normal way of doing things for a moment, I realize just how incredibly strange it is that I'm here in this place. And so he said that was his entire ethos in writing, was to kind of shock the reader into realizing that they were in a coffee shop. And there's something that he says in his autobiography that I think really captures the heart of everything that Chesterton ever wrote. He says, "The whole purpose of the artistic and spiritual life is to dig for the submerged sunrise of wonder, so that a man sitting in a chair might suddenly realize that he was alive and be happy."
I love that. And he does that so well. I feel like when I emerge from reading Chesterton, I'm just like, I suddenly see wonder in everything that I see. And it's funny, I was thinking about this summer. I got it into my head to read a book of physics. And I just was like, you know what? I was like, you know what? I'm going to start my PhD, and I'm never going to read a book that doesn't have to do with like moral formation stories, which honestly I'm not complaining about, because moral formation and stories and imagination are all things that I love. But I thought, you know what? I'm just going to read a book of physics. So I read this book called The Fabric of the Cosmos, and by Brian Greene. And I will say, I think I only retained about 40% of it. I don't even know if that much. Most of it went straight over my head because I'm not very adept at science. But for me, reading it was it was very much like, looking at the coffee room sign backwards. It was kind of this re-encountering of, I'd often thought of science, these very like particular rules and ways that life went together. But as I read it, and you read about kind of all the theories that they have about how the world holds together, and you realize, first of all, how much we don't know. That was what struck me, of like, we talk about science like it's this provable thing that we all know, and it's very boring and mechanical, right? That's the kind of the imminent frame way of looking at it. I read an author who called it the Kantian world of dead objects, that everything's just kind of, you can poke it and prod it and move it
Taking
around.
their life lessly.
Yeah, exactly. But then I read about, like, I think the thing that struck me most was they talked about these particles that had no physical connection. They were not the same particles, but no matter how far you separated them, they corresponded to each other. And if you bumped one, the other one would move. Like, if you separated them by millions of miles, this would still happen. And they were like, there's literally, we cannot detect what it is. There's some kind of mysterious, invisible connection between these particles. Or they, like, it talked in the book about the idea of string theory, that that the world isn't made up just of atoms, it's made up of these little tiny vibrating strings, and that literally, which means that everything that we experience, the physical world, is like little tiny songs. It's like little tiny vibrations of music that hold together the universe. And of course, I'm reading this, and the first thing that came to my head is, it's like in Narnia when Aslan sings into be, or in Anandale in Tolkien, when he sings and everything sings in response. And I thought, that might not be so different from the actual physical world we live in. And as I was reading it, I had this kind of realization of, the idea of the world being full of dead objects is neither true nor is it scientific. And so for me, I think that the more you press into the world, the more you see this complex, mysterious place that is charged with beauty, that is orderly, and we can't describe why. It was funny because this book was totally from a secular author. He had no apologetic to prove. He was talking about, the world is like, the world as we know it is like dropping an egg on the floor, and then the egg somehow reassembling itself through the ways of chance. He was like, that's like the statistical probability of our world, an egg that is shattered on the floor reassembling itself. And so, anyway, all that to say, that was a place I wasn't expecting to experience the walking, having my world turned upside down and turned back and seeing it's full of wonder. But that was kind of my experience of that. Sorry, that was a long rant about physics, but I enjoyed reading the physics book. Yeah, and then, okay, wait, I wanted to read this little bit from the very, I think this is actually like from the opening scene in Man Who Is Thursday. And we can chat about it, about how it's this picture of Chesterton's kind of philosophy, if he's trying to turn our snow globe upside down so that we might see it for the first time. This is him describing the sunset. All heaven seemed covered with a quiet, vivid, and palpable plumage. You could only say that the sky was full of feathers, and of feathers that almost brushed the face. Across the great part of the dome they were gray, with the strangest tints of violet and mauve, and an unnatural pink or pale green. But towards the west the whole grew past description, transparent and passionate, and the last red-hot plumes off it covered up the sun like something too good to be seen. The whole scene was close about the earth as to express nothing but a violent secrecy. The very empyrean seemed to be but a secret. It expressed that splendid smallness which is the soul of local patriotism. The very sky seemed small. I just love that. I mean, for one thing, it's incredibly poetic and lovely. But it's also, he's just describing a sunset over a neighborhood in this way that you suddenly see it kind of painted with mythic colors and kind of holding its very own secrets. And he's holding your hand and walking with you and being like, look at this wondrous, strange world that we live in. Do you have any other, oh, there's so much that could be said about orthodoxy. Do you have any other good thoughts on orthodoxy before we leave them to read it themselves?
You talk about how he paints the world in that scene as sort of a mythical picture. I think that's really profound. And I think that's something that he tried to do a lot, was to get us to see our place in a story. He was sort of like N.T. Wright in that way.
Who is here at St. Andrews?
If you read anything by him or heard him lecture, he, N.T. Wright says that the purpose of the Bible was not to give us a guidebook of morals to live by, but to situate us in a story and to say, this is what happened in the past, and this is where we are now, and we are living out a story that was begun centuries ago, and we actually have a part to play. We have agency in determining how the story takes place and what happens. And so N.T. Wright, who's been described as sort of the modern-day heir to C.S. Lewis, sort of recast the world in mythical frame, in a mythical frame, and he's gone a long way, more than I would say any other theologian of our era, to helping to re-enchant the world for religious people. I think that's something that Chesterton does in his writing, and you can see the influence of Chesterton on Lewis and Tolkien, who were both devout Chesterton readers. In his essays, there's one essay he writes that is just delightful, and if you haven't read it, you should read it. It's called On Chasing After One's Hat in the Rain. And he says, a lot of people don't like to chase their hats when it's raining because they find it very inconvenient. But if you imagine that you are Jason and the Argonauts, and the hat is the golden fleece, and it's just escaped out of your hand, and you are running through the streets through a horde of dragons trying to get the hat, then suddenly it becomes a mythic adventure. And so his whole MO was for us to see that even when we can't see it, even when it seems very frustrating and mundane, and even when we're saddled with homework and taxes and bills, life actually has a mythic urgency to it. And we're here very briefly, and we have choices to make. And he says one thing that I think is incredible. He says, nothing is so dangerous as the moment of making a choice. All heaven stands still when a man or a woman is choosing to do something. And all eternity hinges on that moment. Where in the ancient epics, people, only very special people, got to live out some epic story. Chesterton saw the epic hero in the modern day man and woman, the everyman in the street. He said that we are all Odysseus. We are all Jason. We're all the disciples following Jesus.
I love that. And it reminds me of another book of Chesterton's, which is Man Alive. It's very much doing what you're talking about, which is it's kind of tracing the life of this one man, and they're having this huge mystery, and who is he? And it's like this, and then you realize that it's just kind of, it all conspires to that idea of this one man who discovers life as wondrous, as being planted in the midst of a myth. And I think that actually translates us very well to the next example, which is our musical. So if we think about Chesterton as helping us re-enchant the natural world, and I think Chesterton does much more than that, but that's kind of, you know, what we're using orthodoxy for, to think about if we're thinking through these categories of how do we re-enchant the natural world and see it as charged with wonder and beauty. The next thing we want to talk about is breaking the immanent frame of self. As we talked about earlier, that's kind of the sense of a emphasis on individualism, kind of the isolated self, that we don't define ourselves in the midst of our community or our choices, but rather is this kind of isolated astronaut. We think of everyone as astronaut people kind of floating in space as though they don't have a relationship, as though their choices don't have a relationship to the rest of the world. And so the next example we're going to be looking at, which very naturally connects with this idea of living in the midst of a myth or a story, as N.T. Wright helps us think about our lives, is Dear Wormwood by the Oh Hellos. Now, it's funny, I kind of bundle memories together oftentimes around, like, when I encounter a piece of art or a story. And I think I actually encountered this album around the same time that I discovered your Twitter, which I don't know why I remember that, I just do. And it was because it was around the time that in Colorado, we had a winter, the winter 2016, it's like the beginning part of that. We got snowed in, I think, literally 10 times from like January to April. And in one of those times, I listened to this album. My friend had sent it to me, and I was locked inside. And so I did the natural thing, which was to watch the Lord of the Rings extended edition, as we were snowed in for 3 days, as one should, with my brother Joel. And then I listened to this album over and over again. And it is by this delightful band. They're actually going to be in Scotland on Sunday, called the Oh Hellos. It's a sibling. There's a brother and a sister who are at the middle of the band, and they do a good deal of the writing and everything. But then they kind of have this delightful conglomeration, depends on where they are, of instruments and kind of a delightful performing band that comes with them. And this album called Dear Wormwood, which obviously is a nod to Lewis and the Screwtape Letters, is kind of, now I've always understood it to be, it kind of traces this character's development as a person through kind of confronting their Wormwood. So in Screwtape Letters, Wormwood is this demon who's the tempter of the human. It's kind of one of Lewis's odder works, really. But so it's kind of, it traces the development of this character, and the sister and the brother at various times throughout the album kind of voice different characters, will voice a narrator. And it starts with this, here where the opening track is, but it's basically about this guy leaving a girl because he's decided that she's not good for him, and that he is kind of being drawn to something that is damaging him as a person. And it draws through that, and then it goes through these kind of, it kind of goes in this mythic interlude. And then it comes out at the very end. There's a song called Dear Wormwood, where he basically says, I've kind of confronted you. And it's him kind of confronting the bits of his character and his choices, the things that have been moving and shaping him into the person he doesn't want to be. And he kind of comes face to face with Wormwood. And then at the very end, it's the Danse Macabre, which is, you know, the dance of death, of him kind of facing the choices he'll make in this short time on Earth and their personal ramifications, but also this deep sense of them being planted in a myth or in a story. And they do this in just really interesting and creative ways. I love the, there's, what's it called? It's called Caesar, and it kind of is talking about the inevitability of death, but then of spring. And that it's coming back, and that in the sense of as he dies to himself, that spring will always come back and will always bring a renewing life and a renewing redemption. And I just, this album just kind of grabbed my imagination. Everything from the story that it tells from beginning to end, to the way that it uses music to kind of enchant this experience. Like in Caesar, it's this very kind of, it's somber, and it kind of feels like you're being enchanted. It kind of draws you into a misty moor, and the way they use instruments and storytelling. So anyway, so to me, what Dear Wormwood does is that it places, as Bose was talking about, it places your decisions, yourself, your sense of living, and choices that you make in the midst of a mythic narrative. It helps us see this one character who's just doing the very simple thing of leaving a destructive relationship and moving towards health and towards goodness in the context of this kind of mythic battle for his life and his soul, and helps situate you in the context of that, which I think is really a beautiful way of helping break out of the immanent frame of the kind of the captured self, of the self that's isolated from others, from narrative, from a meaning beyond just the individualistic choice, and kind of a hollow existentialism. So that is what I really enjoyed about Dear Wormwood. Did you, so you said you listened through it. Have you listened to it before, or was this your first time listening to it?
I don't know if I'd ever listened to it all the way through, but I have listened to them before and to that album particularly.
Did you have any thoughts along the either the actual album or that idea of kind of planting the self in the midst of myth and of story, and kind of reconnecting the self to the things that make us, you know what I mean? The relationships, community, narrative, the sense of I'm not just an isolated self divorced from all the things that make me who I am.
I think when I listened to it, I was mostly struck by the music.
Yeah.
I think it's great that you were able to pull it out of it. I'd have to listen to it again with that perspective that you've just given us.
But I find it delightful music too. A spectacle in some ways. Like if you watch them, they're kind of a spectacle in a good way. Like in the sense of there's different, every song is made kind of with different instruments and with a different band, and there's a sense of a show, which I kind of like too.
Have you been to one of their concerts?
I have not, and I really wanted to go to the one on that's on Sunday night in Glasgow, but one of my dearest friends is leaving town, and I didn't want to go and not get to say goodbye to her, so. But I hope to catch them at some point. I have stalked their YouTube channel deeply. So, anyway, but I would very much encourage you all to listen to Dear Wormwood and allow it to shape your sense, to let it draw you into the story and enjoy the music and let it re-enchant your sense of the importance of your choices and the way that you are planted in a story. So let's move on then to The Lord of the Rings. And that of the way that it shapes our experience of time and helps us break out of the imminent frame of linear time that doesn't have any meaning. So when we were talking about, you're probably at the very beginning thinking, okay, you're talking about fairy tales, but is The Man Who Was Thursday a fairy tale? And this is kind of retrospectively telling you what I was doing, for listeners. I'm taking fairy tale as the description that Tolkien gives in his lovely essay on fairy stories. And he says that a fairy story kind of has three components. The first is that it's a world unto itself that operates according to its own rules, that it has the air of fairy, I think is the way he talks about it. It's the air that blows in that strange country, that there's something kind of intangible that we feel about the strangeness of fairy stories. And then finally, he uses this phrase, which is kind of the key part that I'm going to be talking about with Lord of the Rings, called the Yew Catastrophe, which is the sudden good turn. So, I think that in its own funny way, The Man Who Was Thursday fits as a fairy story because it is a world that operates according to its own rules, and it has the strangeness, and it does have the Yew Catastrophe too, and in a very odd way. You'll have to read it to know. But for this last bit, I really wanted to focus on the idea of Yew Catastrophe. And I'll finish this. We'll end the podcast with this beautiful passage from On Fairy Stories. But basically, the idea of the Yew Catastrophe is it's the moment that you come, it's like where everything in the story is tumbling to the edge of utter chaos and utter destruction. And then there's this moment of breath in, suddenly everything comes together. The egg that was dropped on the floor comes back into its form wondrously and incomprehensibly. And that this is one of the key signs of a fairy story. Another way, Frederick Buechner, I think that's how you say his name, who is a delightful writer. Have you read any? I'm assuming you've read Buechner.
Yeah, I read his essay on fairy stories.
Yes, and he uses a different phrase. He says that the end of fairy stories are always revelations. So for him, he's kind of like, not all, if you've read any Grimm's fairy stories, they don't all end well, but they all end surprisingly. There's a sense of kind of unfolding that comes at the end. And that kind of comes with this idea of life as a story, of life as having an arc and a meaning and a tension. And that it helps us believe in Yew Catastrophe. And as a believer, we have this sense that there is always at the heart of everything a hope. That beneath every story, both within our own stories, that there's never a moment in which our lives will be without hope. But also in the broader sense of the myth that we are living in, the story that the Bible, as Bose was talking about, that the story that the Bible tells is not just a handbook. It's this sense of planting us in the myth of God's love towards the world. That at some point, all of this pessimism and this undoing will be undone. There will be a moment of Yew Catastrophe, and that is a part of living as a Christian. And that when you go to church, that's like a mini picture as we take the Eucharist. That's like a picture of that moment of Yew Catastrophe that is supposed to be for the whole world. And then in some way, as we read stories that touch on that, it helps us see the world as waiting for that Yew Catastrophe. It helps us see time not as a linear thing, but as a thing that's waiting for rebirth and waiting for beauty. And yeah, do you have anything to chip in there, Bose, before I continue talking forever about it? Because I could.
No, that was perfect.
I think, okay, so what for Lord of the Rings, how that connects to me. I remember when I first read it, I actually read it surprisingly late. I felt kind of a little bit embarrassed because I'm the youngest of four, and so of course all of my siblings, read it when I was like, I mean, my closest sibling is 6 years older than me, so they were all reading it when I was like a very young child, and so I kind of they almost skipped me. So I read it when I was actually just before I went to Oxford. I read it the whole year before, and what struck me about it was that in Lord of the Rings, each character has their moment of coming up to the edge of doom, the edge of I might die. And not just I might die and it might not be worth anything. That's kind of the question that people experience over and over again in Lord of the Rings. And then coming to that point and choosing either to give in to despair or to believe that there will be a catastrophe, and that in believing that they will do the right and the noble and the good thing, though it shouldn't their life, though it should be the sacrifice of their story to a greater story. Tolkien's like the great mystery of all of human life is that we're all reckoning with the strangeness, both that we live and that we will die, that each story is kind of coming up against that mystery of life and of the idea that we will, that there is some hope tucked underneath, but that that's something that we live in hope of and not in the experience of. And for me, as I read Lord of the Rings, I read it at a very important moment in my life because there were some things that could have tended me towards feeling hopeless, or towards feeling not just hopeless as a person, but hopeless in the sense of like that my living, my choices, doing the hard things might not make a difference. I was Sam in Mordor going, what if I just, I just die and it's no different? Like, what if it doesn't make a difference? What if I come to the edge of doom and it means nothing? And so reading that for me was this encouragement to live for hope, to live for your catastrophe. And okay, of course there's the Sam. Sam has so many good quotes in the books. Okay, so this is the one I wanted to read you all. This is Sam in The Return of the King, and they're in the middle of Mordor, and there are these two tiny hobbits, and there seems no sense that they could make it all the way through. And Sam, this is kind of Sam's moment. There, peeping along the cloud rack, above a dark tor high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart. As he looked up out of the forsaken land, a hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing, that there was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. And for me, that is one of the things that Lord of the Rings taught me and helped me see was the shadow is only a passing thing, that it tucked into my heart that hope of the catastrophe of everything suddenly coming right. That's one of the most difficult things I think to believe in when we're trapped in this kind of way of experience in the world, is that there's hope, that there's a beyond, that there's an undoing of all that is bad. Have anything to add, Bose?
We need that hope desperately. And I think this is something that you and I have talked about before, is that Lord of the Rings was the best-selling novel of the 20th century. I think that has a lot to do with what Charles Taylor talked about, was with the haunting. I think if we weren't living in a disenchanted age, Tolkien and Harry Potter and these other stories might not be as popular, but Tolkien and Harry Potter and Star Wars and these stories, they appeal to us because they're almost medieval in the way they create a world that is bounded and governed by ritual, tradition, and community. You look at the Shire and you want to live there because these people are all friends with each other and they all support each other. And you look at Harry Potter and they have the rhythms of the school year, they have things that they do every year, like the Halloween feast, the midnight parties, and they're all bonded so closely. And we don't have that sort of sense of community here in the West anymore. Tolkien really captured that. And I think what it says is that this longing is something that we feel, and it's not wrong to feel that, and it's not hopeless to feel that, because someday, you talked about hope and about the world changing and light breaking in. Someday the light will break in again. Even though we're surrounded by the orc armies, the light will pierce through the walls of Helm's Deep. Gandalf will ride down, and we will break out of the system that we've been imprisoned in for the last 200 or 300 or 500 years, and we'll have community again, and we'll have relationships with each other that are actually meaningful, and we'll see that life was a story that we were a part of that was tremendously beautiful and so much more meaningful than we ever imagined when we were living it.
Yeah, and I think something else that struck me as you were talking is that I think that it is impossible for us to live in a way that will make a difference if we don't hope, if we don't have the hope of eucatastrophe. You know what I mean? We won't live for meaningful relationships if we don't have a hope that someday all of this isolation and all these things will be undone. Hope is the thing which sustains us to live lives of goodness and to live lives of meaning. And yeah, it's interesting. I was talking with my sister wrote on this as well about, you know, these very best-selling books being these fantasies. And I think you're right about how, because we are all experiencing the haunting, there's something about fantasies too, I think on a very like basic level, that people feel like they can give in to seeing the world as enchanted and beautiful in a book because they go, oh, well, it's just a story, which of course none of us ever believe it is just a story. But it's kind of a guilt-free way of people being able to breathe out and immerse themselves in a world that is enchanted. But I think that the popularity of those books really speaks to that need. And Sarah was saying that also we were talking about how, you know, World War II in some ways kind of shattered the world in ways that are still kind of echoing and reverberating. And, you know, I think being in the UK makes me realize that even more, because there's even still these kind of symbols of the sense of the presence of that it wasn't that long ago, that people still remember it. And one of the main things that was difficult was that people were trying to reckon with the goodness of God and this experience of deep pain and evil. Of course, there are good theologians, and I'm not downing that at all, but there was a sense of kind of the inadequacy of creating a theory that explained how God could allow this kind of evil. That Sarah kind of argued, and I think this is true, that the place that people experienced a sense of this makes sense of it to me is in story. It wasn't in, you know, an exact philosophical or theological explanation. It was in the experience of these stories that help us understand and place ourselves in a context. And I think that's so true. And just on a very personal level, like when I am feeling disenchanted myself, when I am the person who most wants to believe and has difficulty believing, there's nothing that will bring me back into that way of seeing like reading these stories. It helps me see the world again and be washed with a sense of hope and of newness. And so I think that I hope that this podcast, it certainly has encouraged me, and I hope that it has encouraged you all to know that fairy stories, renewing your imagination, living into the wondrous and strangeness of the world is not, it is not of a half importance. It is deeply important. It is a part of our battle plan against disenchantment, against hopelessness, and against cynicism. And that to truly live well and to live in anticipation of the eucatastrophe, we have to break out of that, that flat way of seeing the world. And so I wanted to end with this quote by Tolkien and let you end with this good thing as we close up this podcast. Thank you, Bose, so much for being on. I really hope that we can do another one in the future. I really enjoyed just discussing these things that we love and that have shaped us. This is a quote from Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, which I'll attach in the show notes. And may you all have beautiful weeks. The consolation of fairy stories, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, of the good catastrophe, the sudden joyous turn, for there is no true end to a fairy tale. This joy, which is one of the things which fairy stories can produce supremely well, is not essentially escapist, nor fugitive. In its fairy tale, or other world, setting, it is a sudden and miraculous grace, never to be counted on to recur. It does not deny the existence of die catastrophe, of sorrow and failure, The possibility of these is necessary to the joy of deliverance. It denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, the universal final defeat, and insofar is Evangelium giving a fleet glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief.
This has been Speaking with Joy. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a comment on iTunes.